Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Welcome back to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today is The Stacks Book Club, where we break down one book in detail with a guest. The book this week is Jesus's Son by Dennis Johnson. And yes, there are some minor spoilers. Our guest is none other than Dave Cullen, author of Columbine and Parkland. You can hear Dave on last week's episode, which I recommend if you haven't heard it yet. Also, as a reminder, everything we talk about on today's show can be found in the show notes. Click that link to take you to all the books and movies and more that we discussed today. You can find links to our social media accounts and more in the show notes. If you love the show and want to help support the work we do, please consider joining us on Patreon. Patreon is a website that allows listeners like you to help creators like me keep creating content. The best part is you also earn perks like our virtual book club, voting on decisions that happen around the Stacks, and a lot more. So to join the Stacks pack, head over to patreon.com/thestacks. I also want to shout out Karen Salgado, who's an outstanding, loyal member of the Stacks pack. It's through Patreon that I've been able to connect with wonderful listeners like Karen. So thank you for your support of the show and just generally for being awesome. If you're an audiobook person, I'm sure you've heard of Audible. They're the number one name in the audiobook world. If you're new to audiobooks, you should check them out. What's great about Audible is they have a wide selection of books. They rate the books based on the book itself, also the performance of the reader, which can be crucial. You also own every book that you get through Audible, so even if you leave Audible, that book is still yours. Plus, any listener of The Stacks who is new to Audible can get a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts and that you leave us a rating and a review. I know I ask this every week, and I promise I wouldn't ask if it wasn't important to helping spread the word about the show. So if you haven't done so yet, please take a moment to leave a review. And trust me, I read every single review, and I'm so, so grateful for all of you. So thank you. Okay, now it's time for you all to hear Dave Cullen and I discuss Jesus's Son by Dennis Johnson. And we also talk about a whole lot more. All right, everybody, we are back again with author Dave Cullen. We're just going to dive in. So today we're talking about Jesus's Son by Dennis Johnson. It's a collection of short stories. It's a backlist title. It came out in 1993, and it follows a guy and his experiences as a drug addict and kind of with his crowd of friends, companions, people he encounters. It's a little dark, a little twisty, my kind of thing. So we'll just dive in. I always start with this question. What did you think of the book? And you've read it. You've read it multiple times. Yeah. It's one of your favorites.
I suggested it.
You suggested it.
I adore this book. And more so with every passing year, really. Mm. And the New York Times did a list of like 25 great books of the last 25 years or something. Mm. And it was on it. It was 5 or 10 years ago. But I think its stature has grown over time.
Interesting.
I don't think it quite had that reaction when it came out. And he won the National Book Award later.
Okay.
Tree of Smoke. Which I didn't finish. I couldn't get through. Which I don't think is nearly. But you know what? Yeah, this is his classic. I was thinking, like, well, maybe I just think that. But no. So the last book he did before he just died about a year ago. And the last book, which is quite extraordinary, The Largesse of the Sea Maiden, which I thought I hated the title until you read it and you get where that line comes from, is just something else. But anyway, a lot of the reviews I read basically said that his classic is Jesus' Son. In fact, I think a few of them even mentioned he won the you know National Book Award for Tree of Smoke, but the one that people love him will really mention is Jesus' Son.
Interesting.
And for me too, when I read it, I thought it was a book I loved. Hmm. And maybe it is something about the subject matter. Like I didn't think of it as a classic. And I didn't think, when I first read it, I don't think I thought of it as one of my 10 favorites ever, which it definitely is now.
Okay.
And I don't have a set list exactly, so there's probably more than 10 on
it. Sure.
my 15 books crammed on my top 10 list, but I don't freaking care, you know?
Right. Like, it's your list.
It's my list of favorites. But I don't think it was, but the for one thing, I go back to it constantly and literally go back and read passages and remember and try to get what he was doing. I've been learning from him from this for the last 20 years or so and admiring, and more as I read other things that are wonderful and beautiful. And I keep thinking like, wow, this is like almost as good as Jesus' Son. I can't tell how many books I've like thought like, wow, in a way this is like Jesus' Son is like, but like never anywhere. Like the longer it's gone, because you know how like, I think most of us with books, movies, with everything, some really stick with us and some like you forget an hour and a half later. And sometimes we're sort of surprised. I think this is one that surprised me a little. And it's really, he does so many things with it that are just so amazing. And I don't know if you know either, like, because we could tell them, I sprung this on you late too. Because like, I continue, like, you kept reminding me, we had to pick up a book. And I'm like, okay, I'll get to that. I'll get to it. About a week ago, I'm like, oh my God, we're doing that in a week. I'm going to LA. because we're taping like a week after the 20th anniversary of Columbine. And I did so much media about that and podcasts and stuff. And it was April 20th. I could not think through past that day.
Right, of course.
Until the next day, basically, it was a Sunday. I'm like, okay, now what's on my schedule? Like, oh, I'm going to LA on Friday. Oh, my God, that's why she's been saying she needs a book. It's like, she has to read something by then. I'm like, oh, my God. So I didn't mean to be like, screwing you.
No, it's fine. But I was
like, just, you know, you're doing you've dealt with writers before.
A week isn't so bad for me to read a book, to be honest. So here's the thing that I found interesting about this. I am a reader and I am not a writer. Like I don't write and I don't particularly like to write when I have to. And I say that I'm not a writer, but I do review everything that I read. So I do write a little bit, but I don't like it. And so I'm very curious about this book. So a friend of mine mentioned that this is like one of those books that if you're a writer, you have to read
it's
it.
It's a writer's book. Totally.
And so I don't know that I connected with it completely because I don't know that I appreciate writing as much as I appreciate story. And so while I liked that it was the same narrator throughout, I really liked that. I felt like I was missing a lot because I was like, it's an interesting story. Like, but I don't know that I understood what I was supposed to be looking for. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. And I totally. And I get that from people all the time who like love to read a lot and they're like, oh, I don't feel worthy. It's like, well, what do you like? Like, you know what? But I think writers get some of the stuff, sort of like the magic behind the curtain.
Right.
But I think if I had to pick one single thing, well, voice is up there, but like, I would say insight. And I mean, and I was saying in the previous episode about Jonathan Latham, and I mean insight about everything, even describing a scene, the connections he makes to other things and the way, but he weaves into it just insights about the world. Let me jump to something like, can I like read a paragraph?
Yes, go ahead.
Right here, like it's one of my, okay, I got two in the book that I just think are so fantastic. And this is, it's from Beverly Home, the last book. And by the way, you know, you said this guy, like, so there's also this debate of whether it's the same guy, but like, I also accept that
it is because he has the same name in two or three of the stories, Fuckhead or whatever they call it.
Exactly. So he's never actually named, but yeah, just
but
Fuckhead.
But he has like the same... The same guy.
Yeah, right. Pretty much. But there's a debate.
I agree with you.
Oh, interesting. Some people are like, oh, it's different points in his life. And sometimes an ex-alcoholic. Sometimes it was a drug addict.
I just thought he did both things.
Yeah, exactly.
I figured if you're doing heroin, you're probably drinking. I don't know.
Exactly.
That might have been my assumption.
Different versions of the same guy.
Yeah.
So they made a movie of him where they put it all together. Billy Crudup plays him.
Of course.
It's perfect for him. But like all sorts of great, you know, sort of like art house people are in it. It's not a fantastic, it's like a B+, A- movie.
It seems like it would be like kind of like a cult favorite type thing.
It is.
I was going to cast Adam Driver in this.
Oh, I could see. Okay, I could totally see.
Right? Yeah. Isn't he like, but they're like the same kind of guy.
When he was younger.
Yeah, they're like the same guy.
Yeah.
They kind of are.
Adam Driver's the young Billy Crudup. And they listed him as Fuckhead in the credits. Okay, so here's the passage in Beverly Home, which is Beverly Home is a halfway house where this guy is now like working. He's an ex-alcoholic and he's working, but seeing these different people. There was a guy there with something like multiple sclerosis. A perpetual spasm forced him to perch sideways on his wheelchair and peer down along his nose at his knotted fingers. This condition had descended on him suddenly. He got no visitors. His wife was divorcing him. He was only 3, I believe he said, but it was hard to guess what he told about himself because he really couldn't talk anymore beyond chomping his lips repeatedly around his protruding tongue while groaning. No more pretending for him. He was completely and openly a mess. Meanwhile, the rest of us go on trying to fool each other.
Hmm.
Now, that's one of my favorite passages ever written.
Mm.
But, and I, you know, and it illustrates several things. One of them is that, and you know, I say insight about human beings and how we treat each other.
Mm-hmm.
And about this guy and what life would be like for him. And all the ways, like, if you were to, like, get multiple sclerosis and mm-hmm. you were to descend on you, like, your friends might drift away. Your wife divorcing you, probably just because they couldn't freaking deal.
Right.
And I love the things like, even like giving his age, which normally you would just give a character's age, but like, I believe he said, but I couldn't really understand it.
Right.
He bets that right. Right. He's like, oh. But then I also love, not that I'm usually up for like those sort of like, I don't want to say the cheap unearned or like the moment of like wisdom, but like, I love that, you know, no more pretending for him anymore.
Right.
That's one of my favorite just sort of moments of, well, and then the thing right after, which is like, I mean, what I'm saying it out of thing, it almost sounds like a Hallmark card kind of, well, or a reverse Hallmark card maybe. You know, meanwhile, the rest of us go on trying to fool each other. I just think that's one of like the, I mean, that's right up there to me with Shakespeare with All the World's a Stage. Mm. That, you know, we're all performing and that like life's a comedy and stuff. It's like,
right.
That like, we're all damaged people. And we're all performing and we're like, we're all big freaking messes.
Right.
On the
right.
inside. And like this guy, so he came up with a character, was the embodiment of how all of us kind of feel about ourselves. And I mentioned imposter syndrome the last 3 weeks, so maybe it's just me, but I think all of us.
Yeah.
Like not quite this literal.
Right.
But like a version of this big mess inside. And he just like, so Dennis just gives you that actual guy. Mm-hmm. And then makes the connection that's like he's completely and utterly a mess. And the rest of us just go on, you know, trying to fool each other. I'm like, that's life.
Hmm.
That's my life. That's everybody's life of like being that guy, but like this facade fooling everybody. And I just like, and that's just like, you know, dropped in there and
right.
just keeps going. There's not one more goddamn thing about this guy. I think that's the guy's entire appearance
yeah.
in the book.
Yeah. He does that throughout the book. He kind of like gives us these characters, none of which are particularly pleasant as you might think of them, but all are like very rich and short. I mean, this book is 130 pages and every story has like a full page break before and after. Like there's yeah. not a lot
and
in
the
this book.
Is,
yeah.
It's like not that much out of it.
Like if this was a regular book, it would be like a pamphlet.
Yeah.
You know, like it's very short. And I do really like that, like the economy of language mm-hmm. and the economy of talking about things like real, it's like he probably wrote like a billion words yeah. and then just edited it all
right.
out.
Yep.
And you do get that sense that like every word is, it's almost like poetry in that sense,
yep.
like that every word is deliberate.
Yep.
And you could imagine that like every, there's a choice, which makes sense why you keep returning to it because there's more and more there each time.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks ago we did Beloved on the show mm-hmm. and I had the same kind of thing where I was like, I liked it, but I didn't quite get it. And my guest had also read it and she was like, we were uncovering things together and she was mm-hmm. telling me things that she had got in her fifth or sixth read through. And I was like, right. That's why these kind of books are yeah. classics, because you can revisit
yeah.
and you can find like
yeah,
what,
of-
yeah. Like the first read is almost like throwaway, you know, so you have to just dive in and then you revisit it in a year and you're like, oh wow, sure. That's what he was saying. I get it now. Like, so I liked that.
Maybe because his lead character is so, well, it's kind of a mess too.
Mm-hmm.
It always is like unassuming about the world, but just like knocking over little nuggets of just, wisdom all the time. Okay, I'm going to like read the other paragraph
okay.
I want to do. Like this combines, I think, some of the most vivid description and insights or just whatever. So this is from the book, the first story called Car Crash While Hitchhiking, which...
Great title.
I know. Like, I,
great
how
title.
Could I, like, I just,
all the titles are great.
I know. I cannot even like... And if that doesn't sound like a great title to you, then probably... Jump ahead to the next episode because this book probably isn't for you.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
This is just like not your cup of tea. But if you think like, oh, I want to read that car crash while hitchhiking. And it is. And of course, it's about that. So this is after the crash and then they're at the hospital. Down the hall came the wife. She was glorious, burning. She didn't know yet that her husband was dead. We knew. That's what gave her such power over us. The doctor took her into a room with a desk at the end of the hall, and from under the closed door, a slab of brilliance radiated, as if by some stupendous process, diamonds were being incinerated in there. What a pair of lungs! She shrieked as I imagined an eagle would shriek. It felt wonderful to be alive to hear it. I've gone looking for that feeling everywhere. That's also one of my favorite paragraphs ever.
That's written. So good, yeah.
And I'll tell you why. So let's deconstruct some of the reasons. Okay. Why, so, like you said, poetry, so much is packed in there. First of all, the slab of light under a door. Like, mm-hmm. We've all seen that, right? You can picture some hallway from some movie.
Right.
There's a door and there's a slab. So who would even describe the slab of light?
Right.
But if you were going to, a slab of brilliance radiated as if by some stupendous process diamonds were being incinerated in there. So, like, I mean, that's just this amazing, glorious thing, which maybe begs the question, like, well, is he over-describing it? He's describing what he's doing. This is the sleight of hand. This is what the writer's magic, like, he's describing the mood. He's conveying the mood. He wants to, that's the deflection. That's the, like he's pretending to describe a slab under the door as a way to make you feel the shudder of glory of feeling like, not just like the beauty of diamonds, but taking that one step further, like, you know, if somebody could describe a diamond, how beautiful it is, like, well, imagine what it'd be if somebody crushed them and like the glow that it radiated. He's putting you in that frame of mind where you're picturing the most beautiful thing in the world you could imagine at the moment that a woman is finding out her husband died. And then the next line after this line that's like, you know, 3.5 lines long, that is so many big words that I stumbled 3 times. I didn't do that on purpose, but couldn't get the word. It's difficult to read.
Right.
The very next line is, what a pair of lungs, with an exclamation point. So he hasn't even told you that she screams.
Right.
You know, he didn't describe the scream.
Right.
Instead, he described the brilliance under the door. And while you're reveling in the unimaginable beauty, he just hooks you with the fact that this woman just found out. And it's all sort of off character. Just got told her husband's dead. And she's just wanting. So he's intercutting these things at the same time. Yeah, and the diamonds is just put you in a mood and make you feel glorious and then get hit by it. And here's the thing, like, I was in a book club where people really hated that paragraph and cited it as a moment where the narrator is mean or an asshole, that he was unsympathetic to the woman, that like, oh, she's screaming. I didn't read it that way at all. He already knew she was dead. I mean, the husband was dead. Like, he told us.
Right.
And we knew, and he knew that she was going to find out, and this was going to be horrible. He knew something horrible was going to happen, and they were just waiting, like, getting the bad news there. And then at that moment, he just hears something really beautiful. It's like, he finds a different kind of beauty, and he goes right from the beauty of the diamonds. And maybe that's why the setup, why I don't know if we normally would have bought the line if somebody said, like, oh, she found out her husband was dead and she shrieked like an eagle and it was really beautiful.
Right.
No. Who would have ever bought that?
Right.
But because it's right on the heels of the diamond incineration, you're already in that beautiful moment. And I think the beauty of the one in your mind fuses in and it allows the next one to work. I go right there because I was already reveling the beauty. The beauty of the. And then I also. The next line, too, I mean, it's one thing after another. I felt wonderful to be alive to hear it. I've gone looking for that feeling everywhere. So here's a guy who was, like, literally a drifter.
Right.
I mean, he's like a hitchhiker.
He's a hitchhiker.
He's always, you know, gotten into the story. And clearly, nowhere to go, nothing going on, a complete mess, he's an addict, blah, blah, blah. This is such a moment of realization of, like, in this moment, and then, like, you know, the hitchhiking goes horribly awry, there's a terrible car crash, people are dead, the baby lives. But in that moment, he finds a moment of beauty and is like, that's why life matters. There's beauty in the world. And it's that moment. And like, not only does he appreciate the beauty, he goes looking for it everywhere and spent the rest of his life looking for that in the world.
And it's real life in the sense that, like, in those moments when you know something terrible has happened or is going to happen, or you're about to watch someone's whole world, you might not be thinking what you think as a reader reading it.
Exactly.
Like, in that moment, he probably was like, oh my God, she's going to go and find out. And, like, he's becomes fascinated with this light because that's the thing that's an escape for him.
Exactly.
In that
some
moment.
Some detail he's obsessing over.
Right. Yeah. And then it brings him back with her scream, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think also, like, maybe I'm reaching, and maybe this is just, like, after hearing you talk about it, I'm like, maybe. But that thing that he's chasing, this is the first story. And then, you know, we start to go into his life and his drugs and his this and that. And you often hear people who are addicts talk about, like, they're chasing this high. And so, like, maybe it's that beauty of that pure scream and the light and all that that
like,
in some way is connected.
Yeah. I mean, they call it chasing the dragon.
Right.
And I, you know, maybe it appeals to me too as a writer. I mean, I, you know, the fact that Madonna would call herself an artist always made it hard to call myself an artist. You know, an artistic producer. I mean,
sure.
Pursuit of, like, so maybe everybody doesn't feel this, but I felt like my whole life I'm chasing different things.
Sure.
Like, we're all chasing things. And, like, that's another point of, like, that I really get this guy, and, like, that it, I've never been chasing, like, the sound of an eagle shrieking. Mm-hmm. But with my writing, I'm chasing different feelings that other writers have done for me. I read Nabokov. I'm like, wow, I want to do that. And, like, I can totally get it. We're part of what we're doing is chasing beauty. There's I've been chasing different forms of beauty with my writing and reading and, like, all art and trying to do it in different ways. And it just pinged something in me of, like, I would never, you know, be chasing that one. But I love that you could hear in a cry or any kind. I love that someone could take any kind of thing in life, in ordinary life, and see, although it's a heightened moment in life, obviously, and see a certain beauty in that and realize, that somehow crystallizes a thing that I didn't know before, that I always sort of, like, searching for, but I didn't know it was. You know, I had a prof in writing school who said, until you can name a thing, you can't really get there or figure it out.
Right.
And I was like, I never realized that. And he was talking about the power of writing. And, like, you can write about the thing, but as the writer, then you can choose whether to say it or not. But, like, you have to figure it out. Figure it out means naming it. Mm-hmm. So you haven't completely figured it out yet until you can put a name to it. And I guess that's sort of what a sense of getting here. I'm picturing a guy who's, like, sort of was already for searching something, but didn't know what it was.
Mm.
But it was a moment of clarity.
Right.
It's like, that's the thing.
Right. And it's in relationship to death, which I think often becomes really clarifying for people. Like, in those moments when you're surrounded by or near to or looking down the throat of death, that it's like, that's the thing.
Right.
That was always the thing. I just couldn't figure it out, you know?
Right. It's something powerful happening in your life. I remember when I was in high school. So I was, like, a nerdy and gay, not knowing, a teenager. So, like, you know, so I wasn't, like, dating ever. although I had my first date, like, a few weeks before prom, and then I went to prom with a different girl. So I was still trying, who turned out to be a lesbian too. Like, we found
perfect.
Each other. I know. But anyway, but I remember before I'd ever really dated, so I was, like, a senior in high school, when friends of mine would, you know, guys would complain about their girlfriends or their relationship and stuff, I remember thinking, like, so envious, like, I want to have that problem. To have that, like, oh yeah, I get, like, why that is a thing, and, like, you don't know what to do, and, like, oh, it's frustrating, blah, blah, blah. I can't wait to, like, you know, have those kinds of fucking problems. It's like, and I get a little bit of that too. It's like, here's a guy who's a drifter. He doesn't, like, find this a life or death thing. Like, I guess he realizes he wants to be back in the game again. Or, like, that's what I'm feeling. Or that's just what it sort of called out to me. Like, this is a moment of life and death. Like, she has a marriage.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing too, is, like, the cry conveyed how much she loved him.
Right.
How desperate she was, how tragic it was to lose her husband, told you how vital he was. Meanwhile, the narrator doesn't have anybody.
Right.
He's out of that game. He's on his own. And he realizes, wow. Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of like a real, I mean, that echoes of all those things of, like, of being in the game. I feel like he's just sort of like, I think what you were saying, sort of like just in a fog and, like, out of it. And it's like, I mean, he's literally, and right after this, when we go back to, like, a detox in a moment.
Right.
Him, But yeah, it's like, yeah, I need to be there where like shrieks are people, life and death things happen and the world matters. And like, I need to live my life again.
Right. Okay. I kind of want to shift a little bit because so last week we didn't really talk about Parkland at all, which is okay. We have this week. So we're kind of going to combine it because there are some similarities, though the stories are obviously totally different and Parkland is a longer narrative, et cetera, et cetera. But I am curious about how you see your job as author, journalist, truth teller in a way, because you're not. The thing that's interesting about what you do and how you do it is that you're not a pure journalist.
Yeah,
you're also not, you're not coming to it completely after the fact. Like you're kind of part of it and you're helping us, your reader and the world, I guess, to dissect and understand what we're seeing on the news. So you're kind of like the character in this book who's kind of both making things happen and also having things happen to him and reacting. So I kind of wonder how you fell into that, like how you decided to write that way when you could have easily been like, I'm a journalist and this is what I saw and who, what, where, when, why, you know?
I love that you brought that up and all those things you said. I'll start at the midpoint of the story. Early on, I set about to do this kind of differently. And the new journalists from the 60s were all sort of my starting point. And, well, and of course, I mean, it helped that, you know, Capote wrote In Cold Blood, right. Was one of them. But I was really more pictured like, you know, I read Tom Wolfe when I was in college, I guess, the electric Kool-Aid acid test. Mm-hmm. But then I liked the right stuff more. Okay. But that
whole, which all journalists like more, I understand.
I guess. Oh,
it's
right?
Journalists like love the right stuff.
It's pretty. And I love amazing things, but like, I knew from the first page, I mean, it's all about, well, it's first about the test pilots and then the astronauts, the Mercury ones, but he doesn't start there. Mm-hmm. The opening scene is the wives. And because there's like some horrible stat, like 1 out of 3 of the test pilots died. Mm-hmm. And so like, which is terrible, but like, that means if you're a wife, like you got a 1 of 3 chance, like, you
being
know.
A widow.
And these are, yeah. And these are mostly like, they're in their 20s and 30s.
Right.
So these are young women and with kids and like, so he opens with like, a plane has gone down. Everybody knows it. And the phone tree goes like crazy. And everybody's waiting for like to get the call from your husband that he's okay. And then somebody, one of their friends, is going to get the two guys to come to her front door and the doorbell ring and the horror. And but he starts there. Mm-hmm. I was like, but that tells you a lot about the way in. But anyway, I'm off the subject. so I read those people and knew like, you know, I tell students that I just did a seminar at Boston University on narrative. And I told the people there, it's like, these are narrative nonfiction writers. And of all different times, you know, some consider themselves journalists, some book, various, whatever, different ways. And I said, like, you know, those people in the 60s decided, it's called the new journalism because they thought journalism was too confining and the rules are too confining for what they wanted to do with long form journalism. Mm-hmm. So, they tossed those rules out and created their own. And thank God, you know, I mean, we're living in a much more interesting literary world. You know, you read nonfiction, probably like almost everything probably that you like is because like building on what they did.
Right, right.
And they created this whole thing for us. You know, they got it started, but it's still kind of exciting because it's only like, you know, like one generation old now. It's still evolving. And, you know, the novel's like, you know, depending how you want to date it, 250 to 350, 400 years old, it's had a longer life. It's more in its mature state.
Right.
This is still going. So you still have the power to invent. And we're still figuring out. So I told people, like you got to figure out which rules you want to go by and what you want to do. And what really helped also along the way, God, I'm going to forget his freaking name. The guy who wrote What It Takes, I believe is the name. He's a titan of the new journalist. My editor, John Karp, got him to read an early manuscript of Columbine, and he liked it. He loved it. He agreed to blurb it. But he wanted to talk to me about it, which John said never happens. But so I got a chance to talk to him about it when I was still doing final edits, and I kind of sheepishly admitted that, like, I don't know if I'm supposed to, like, you know, can I ask you a question? And like, I had several, but one of them was, like, kind of breaking the rules of, like, some of the people in it, I've showed them their part because I want to like get it checked.
Right.
Like with Patrick Ireland, only selected people who had. So Patrick Ireland, by the way, I printed off all the parts on him. I don't know, it was like 30 pages or something. Pulled them all out in one thing, printed it, and did a lunch with them. And you can't have it. I can't send it to you. I don't want it out in the world. But if we sit down and you read it in front of me and like mark it up and tell me.
No pressure.
I know. And he marked up correct lots of little things and, you know, a couple big things like, and a few things was like, oh, well, that's kind of true. But like, you're kind of missing this, like that I didn't know that he'd never told me. I'm like, oh, okay. So it really helped, but it was like fantastic. And the parts I was nervous about, he's like, oh, no, no, it's fine. That happened. I did that. But it really helped. And I did it with Kate Batten, the lead investigator. This took 6 hours. She's got like an encyclopedic memory. That was like, I don't know, 50 or 60 pages. Everything about the killers, their sort of actions and what they did on April 20th, everything that happened there. I can't remember how I cut it off because I couldn't just, you know, the whole book. And it would have spent hours. But we met for lunch at noon and I think left at 6 o'clock. But she did the whole thing in front of me and she found lots of little things and filled in certain things. And she's great too. When she doesn't know, she knows she doesn't know. And several things she said like, well, let me make a note of this and I'll check. And like 3 days later, there's like this giant email with all these like, you know, minor things. And so that really helped make the book. And Fuselier, Agent Fuselier, I let read the whole thing. And also Dr. Frank Ochberg, who's a medical doctor, but a great psychiatrist. Because I also wanted, especially Dr. Ochberg, all of them, the take on the whole picture. I guess I don't know that I've ever told anyone that I let Fuselier read the whole thing. But so I asked Richard, and I guess I hadn't showed it to him yet. I guess I was still weighing that. And Richard Ben Kramer said, he's like, of course you can. And like, and you should if you think it's right. And like, you know who to trust, right?
Right.
You work with these people for years. It's like on what it takes. All, and that was about presidential candidates, Bush and Bob Dole, Democrat for both parties. And it was like six people, and he followed them all the way through the primaries and then the general election. And he was a big name by then, so like they were cooperating. And like he said, I let every one of them read every page on them. And I'm like, really? And he's like, the book is like, John, it's like a page or something. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah. And it's like, and it's a better book because of it. Like, first of all, they corrected. They found lots of things. And like, there were only like two or three times. And I don't know if he ever told this public. So maybe I'm spilling his shit. But he's like, there were only a handful of times where they really disagreed with me on something. And I, you know, went to loggerheads. But in every case, I learned a great deal of why they thought that. And sometimes like, okay, they convinced me they were right. Or they gave me so much other stuff with like explaining like, here's why, you know, I think you missed the boat on that. And told me this other stuff and I still profited with much richer stuff.
Right.
And there was never any, you know, there's nothing in the book that like, oh, I had to take out. He sort of gave me permission, the wire thing of like, follow your goddamn instincts and like whatever the stupid rules of, if you think that rule makes sense, then do it, but you know, do your other thing. So going way back before that, I didn't do either of these books primarily as a journalist, particularly Parkland, but like journalism is a profession. It's one of the professions I do.
Right.
And what I do some of the time and what I'm doing for magazines, I'm essentially a journalist and the books are journalist-ish and that's a part of it.
Right.
But I sort of combine it like the bigger model I have really is cultural anthropologist.
Okay.
So when I was in college and undergrad, there's a few times that like, I grew up Catholic and, you know, the nuns talked about hearing your calling.
Okay.
And of course, I'm a literalist. I take everything. And I'm like, and I wanted to be like, you know, I wanted to be a priest when I was a little kid. Then the Pope. And like, but I was constantly badgering. I remember Sister Mary, my second grade teacher, asking her, I drove her nuts. Like, do you mean, I didn't know the word literal, but I was asking like, do you mean it literally? Like, do you really hear something?
Right.
And she'd be like, you know, trying to explain it, get me frustrated. And I keep like pinning her down. Like, but my reason why I kept asking is because like, I hadn't heard anything. Like, I thought I wanted to be a priest. And it was upsetting to me because I was like, what? And they would compare it like the archangel Gabriel coming to Mary. And like, and I was like, you know, and they would talk about they're getting visited by an angel. And I was like, wait, so I missed that step. That doesn't mean, basically I was like,
who's calling me?
I know. I can't be a priest if I didn't get like, I didn't get the mat. It was basically, I didn't get the mat. Like, I was supposed to get something.
Right.
And then like, and then always, of course, the thing is like, you'll know. And I'm like, it's like, no, but I don't know. Like, that's the problem. I'm like, what do you mean I'll know? Like, what does that look like? What does that sound like? I don't know. But anyway, but like, but I've always, so then later in life, and because I was, you know, such a little Catholic boy, that was so etched to me, like this idea of a calling. I guess I did know a few times in life when to me, it was more like I heard my name. And by my name, I mean my occupation. And it came several times. all the different versions of the same thing, and which I guess got closer. So when I was a freshman in college, this might have gone out of vogue, it has, I think, in cultural anthropology, but the participant observer was one of the big models then. And this book by Napoleon Chagnon, I think, called Yanomamo, The Fierce People, which is about this Yanomamo tribe in the Amazon, I guess Venezuela and Brazil today. But yeah, this whole idea is like, well, that's what I want to do. And I think it wasn't just that's what I want to do. It was more like, that's what I do. I've been doing that since I was a little kid, sort of like diving into groups. Like I've never really fit in groups or been part of a pack. So one time when I was in a job interview, the guy said, like, I feel like you're a butterfly. You flip from thing to thing and interested. And like, you wouldn't be interested this long. And like, I couldn't really argue with him, but it was the first time I'd heard that about myself. But I guess I already knew. So like, I was like, oh, I'd seen it in something else called an experientialist. And I also, when I saw that word for the first time, I was like, oh, that's kind of what I am. I mean, I took drugs in high school, partly, and in college more, just to experience, to know what it was, to go to those places.
Right.
And I've done so many things. I've lived in like 20 different cities. I've gone to Kuwait. Part of the reason I quit my job, go to the army, I was like, I want to know what that was like. And it seemed like the last person in the world to be, that I could be an infant. I was this sort of like gay, awkward, gangly, 90-pound weakling, you know, college kid and like an intellectual and like writing these, you know, radical stuff in my college papers, like, yeah, like infantry soldier, you know, grunt.
Right.
Literally seems like the opposite thing. And so like, I want to do that. I want to be that. Not just like interview. I didn't want to interview soldiers. I wanted to enlist in the army and be one, actually be that guy and discover like, oh, so anyway, so like, yeah, it's like, oh, participant observer. That's like that's a job? And I sort of like feel like I've gone everywhere since then looking for that job. And then Laurie Anderson put it more perfectly. So she's this performance artist, an amazing singer. Mm-hmm. She was married to Lou Reed like the last 10 years of his life, I think. She's an amazing observer of society and of life and people in it, in everything she does. And so in one of her spoken word things, she says something like, I got to find this quote because I quote it lately. She said, but my real job is spy. And she means kind of cultural spy. Again, it's like, that's what I do. I'm like spy. I'm like culture. Like of our culture, I'm spying on the culture and then like translating it back to like, and that's another version of, you know, cultural anthropologist of what, I mean, they're spies on the Yanomamo or, you know, Jane Goodall or she's with apes or like, well, what are you doing with apes? She's spying on apes, right?
Right.
That's what I do. So, I mean, that's what I try to do. And then, I mean, that's the other half. And then the other part is the art of then like how I convey that. And actually something that really helped is like when a friend of mine wrote a blurb for me years ago when I was still struggling, he said, Dave is a cultural translator. And he said, you know, whether it's going like a white guy going to an Arab country or a gay guy going into the army or, you know, going to evangelical embedding and sort of evangelical world and sort of telling that story, goes into these other worlds, feels what it's like there, and then comes back to tell, you know, you convey what it's like. Like, oh, okay, that's what I do. So that's what I try to do. And I try to do these in these books in Columbine in a more straightforward way, but in Parkland, really just like basically embedding in with the Parkland kids and not being a participant. But I, you know, being halfway between participant observer and a journalist, in between, really between a cultural, being more of a cultural anthropologist, and just like, and sort of spy, just like, what, and I want to
definitely
capture,
spy in this one.
Yeah. And capture not just like, in, not just interview them or like ask them their opinions or like write down or describe, like, but, again, like try to get it like I did with the killers with Columbine, like try to get inside their heads.
Right.
And like, what is it like to be David Hogg or, you know, especially you know, Emma Gonzalez or, you know, Jackie Corn, who's like the really sort of like master implementer behind the scenes. And in that case, who's like the not famous person, but who's really making the trains run on tape time and really making it happen. Like, meanwhile, this crushing grief that's coming down on you sometimes too. But what it's like to be those kids and to sort of like put you on the bus across America with these kids and make you feel like you are there. So yeah, my goal was not objectivity. I think objectivity is like, it has a place, journalism, and right. especially certain types of journalism. If you're like, if you're doing a crime story, right. a trial, if you're
or like first systems, reporting.
Yeah, yes, yes, exactly. Or like a lot of financial reporting sure. or like, you know, politics. Yeah, depending upon what you're doing. And I felt like here's like, for a lot of what I do, and with the gay soldiers story, like I've known them for 19 years. I won't say what happens is like at least one wedding, which I've been to. Mm-hmm. I've been to the funeral of family members. Right. I've been to a retirement ceremony. I've hung out at their houses just like for right. weekends of like, you know, well, I wrote the salon piece by just embedding with their world right. for 5 months. So now I've done it for almost 20 years. So I think objectivity can be your enemy. And it's like you know, the whole thing is like distance that we learned in journalism school. You keep this distance like well, I don't want freaking distance. I want to like narrow that distance all the way to their nose and then further inside their brain, inside their body. And I want to tell the story of what it's like to be them.
Right.
So yeah, I'm not trying to tell those stories of like, you know, somebody objective and outside doing the whole thing is like, I want to put you on the bus. As if it were a memoir, one of them written, but with some objectivity too, because I am doing some of that, that can right. reflect on them and does see it as an outsider who isn't caught up in it and isn't just one of them. And also in this case, isn't 17 years old,
right?
You know, and also who's been like, you know, through this for 20 years since before they were born,
right.
seeing these school shootings. So bringing a lot of context to it,
right?
But also, but the parts that's with them is like, yeah, shrinking that distance. Like
right.
distance is my enemy.
Right.
I'm getting right into them and doing that for the reader.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, like the connection that I sense between Parkland more specifically and Jesus's son is that though this is fiction, it feels like the narrator is kind of like embedded mm-hmm. in this world
yeah.
and that he isn't objective. Obviously, he is really more of like an unreliable narrator, mm-hmm. I would say. Right. And like, yeah. he's definitely on drugs in some of the stories. And like, that's fine too. But like that it's his interpretation of what is around him, mm-hmm. not so much necessarily what factually has happened.
Exactly.
And
right.
I think that that's really similar to what you do. But I do wonder, one of the things that came up for me as a person of color reading this book and like someone who is very passionate about reading the works of quote unquote marginalized people. So whether that's sexuality or ableist or race or whatever, is that this book doesn't really exist for like Black people or Asian people or whatever, like that this author being like a white guy oh. has had the latitude to kind of just write these short stories that are like kind of about nothing, you know, and like kind of about unsavory people that he doesn't have to like apologize for. And
oh,
so I was
Black guy did it. People were like, yeah, you're a fucking loser.
Well, like, yeah. And they're drug addicts. Of course. Like yeah. this is a tale so of the bad. Inner city. Like, you know, whereas this is like in Iowa and like, mm-hmm. so I just thought that was really, it was something that's interesting. And obviously because this book came out in 1993. I don't think people were really thinking about that. And like, there were so few, you know, authors of other groups that even were attempting to write their own stories, let alone the stories of just like general humans. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I found that to be something that I was super interested in this book is like, who did this? Who yeah. else has done this? Who isn't a white guy?
Yeah.
Like even women. I mean, white women are given that latitude a little bit. Like we talked about Lucia Berlin.
I was just thinking. Yeah.
Like she kind of is able to do that. But even still, her books are about women and she's saying something really interesting about women and like working class women and that she's not talking about some, I don't know, it's still well, connected,
yeah,
you know?
That, well, you know, there's an interesting thing there. Well, also the fact that like, you know, she wasn't ever a hit in her lifetime. And it's mm-hmm. only the last couple of years mm-hmm. for, you know, who knows, lots of different reasons. But, you know, maybe we weren't ready for a woman to do it. But there's also, there were certain controversies. So, so you know, all the stories were published in her lifetime.
Right.
In magazines or different collections. But one of Angel's Laundromat, she got in a fight with her publisher. I'm trying to remember if I can remember this exactly because I had this conversation with her like 20 years ago. But there were Native Americans and some of them were alcoholics. And her publisher was like, you can't have a Native American as an alcoholic. That's racist.
Right.
And she's like, but I know a lot of them. Like, have you ever been on a reservation?
Right.
Like, alcoholism is a huge problem
right.
on reservations and everybody knows it. And he's like, yeah, but you can't do it as a white woman. And she's like, do whatever. Like, you know, like,
right.
I'm writing about all these things. I'm not like excluding the Native Americans. And like, But, it did. I don't know if it got published there or something. I don't know. But she did. But I mean, she did it anyway. But come to think of it, that was before later Sherman Alexie, mm-hmm. was really the breakout
right,
guy.
Right.
Who, I forgot. I really loved Harry and Tonto, Fist Fight in Heaven.
Mm. It
was freaking amazing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he has the latitude to go there. And there's a right. lot of alcoholics. But, he can do it. And he does it in kind of a beautiful way.
Right. But like the question is then who gets to tell the story, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's his story to yep. tell, whatever.
Yeah. Right. Although in hers, it's like the Native Americans isn't the main character. It's
sure.
still about herself.
Sure.
But yeah, but she's like, I don't, I can only have like white women be the alcoholics.
Well, I think
stories.
That
like,
authors, yeah.
Like anybody, I could populate it with like, Albuquerque has a lot of different kinds of people and like they're all going to these stories.
Right.
And like,
I think the authors should get to write whatever they want to write. And then it's up to the reader and the public to decide if it's a story that they care about or that mm-hmm. they think is real or valid. I mean, obviously you run into an issue if it's like, someone popular is putting this out in the world and people think that this is real because, so I think you run into issues of having to be discerning readers, but
yeah.
I think that you should be able to write what you want and let us decide if it's any good.
Yeah. I think also in that case of Albuquerque, like you have to be careful of like what you wish for because of like, okay, you take all the Native Americans and like all the Latinos out of Albuquerque. And
right.
then, like, you have white Albuquerque, and then you come into the problem that people always made fun of Woody Allen. Like,
right.
you have all these movies set in New York City.
And there's no people of color.
People in it.
It's
yeah,
insane.
Color. It's all white people in New York City. Well, that's almost like what this fictional person that we just made up is asking, like, well, if you
right.
make Lucia take all the people out of color, well, then she's got a white Albuquerque, which
right.
is ridiculous.
Right.
Like,
I mean, also, so the other thing that's in this book a lot, we're not really talking about any of the specific stories,
yeah.
which, because they all kind of bleed together because maybe it's the same narrator. But one right. of the things we were touching on before we started recording was that you had a book club that
oh, yeah.
thought that it was like it was like kind of like a mean book and like not great. And we were saying because of the depiction of all the people who are drug addicts. And I was saying that maybe, it depends on when you read the book and the relationship that we have now to the opioid crisis versus, when this book came out. And even in the last like 3 or 4 years, our relationship to drugs and addiction has really changed as a culture.
Yeah, and I bet that's some of it. I was thinking more to, I was trying to remember exactly what the reaction, the other big reaction was like, was people like trying to explain away addiction or like, and say things like these things like, well, so I was trying to figure out like what he's trying to escape from. And I was like, well, what do you mean? Like, well, I assume addicts are all taking drugs because they hate their life and they're trying to escape or something.
Mm.
I don't think all addicts.
Yeah. I don't think all anything.
Yeah. Exactly.
Absolutes.
But they had all these weird preconceptions and the book should be like a morality tale of like getting off or something. It was like, I found a lot of imposing of like trying to like what this book should be about. These people like
trying to make meaning.
Yeah. Out of it. Like, and they were trying to find in these things like, oh, well, here's where he was escaping. Or I'm like, okay, well, maybe there's some escapism. But I felt like there was a lot of imposing of like their weird, like, reefer madness stuff.
Mm.
And like, and believed it at some level.
Right.
Like, I almost feel like there's a world, divided. People who divide the world into drug addicts and non-drug addicts.
Hmm.
And
it's maybe like more on a sliding scale.
Yeah, I don't. I'm like, and especially like I did a lot of drugs.
Right.
Still have,
right.
now and then. I've never done heroin, but I've done most of the other ones. But I didn't have an addictive personality, which helped.
Right.
And like I've had a few friends who struggle with addiction, but I know a lot of people who, go to parties and, do a lot of like, X and K and G and like, God, they've all got different names now, but like, Molly and, so I sort of like don't divide the world, but, So
but he gets at that in the book.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. If you're, oh, he does. Okay.
Well,
it's been a while since I've heard it.
No, I mean, he gets at this idea that like, it's all kind of the same. Like it doesn't really matter what you're doing and how much of it you're doing. And like, there's the one story, out on bail where he's like at the bar and the friend Joey Hotel or something, who Jack Hotel, who's like out, he's on trial for armed robbery, for robbing some college kids who are dealing drugs. And then they like, he realizes that he isn't out on bail, that he actually got off on the charge because the lawyer was like, who's really the bad guy? The robber or the drug addict who's robbing, or the drug dealers or whatever. And then they both do a bunch of drugs, and both the narrator and Jack Hotel overdose, and the narrator lives and Jack Hotel dies. And it's kind of like, we're all fucked. Like, either you're the addict or the dealer, either you're getting robbed or you're robbing someone, either you're ODing and having someone near you who helps, or you're dying. And like, there isn't a morality around that. It's like that the whole thing is fucked. Like, the whole situation is fucked, whether you get lucky or not, like whether you drink yourself to death, or, you know, he talks about his mom has been strangled by an extension cord by her husband, like that this book really gets at, like, there's darkness everywhere. Yeah. And like, you're not getting out of it, and it's part of it. And there is no judgment to be made on any of these people, because like, how can you say, you know, and there's the story about, I think it's Work maybe, where the Georgie is like the orderly, and the guy comes in with the knife in his eye that his wife has put in his eye. And they're like, they call in all the doctors and like, what's going to happen?
I'll get it out.
And then Georgie just like pulls it out. And it's kind of just like, you have no idea, people. Like, there's no rhyme or reason to any of this. Georgie just as well could have killed this guy, and he didn't. And then they go off and they go do a bunch of drugs, and like, surprise, everyone you know is high, you know?
And I feel like, you know, the metaphors of this book are, some of them are like really in your face, like, yeah, that, but yet really work. Like, he pulls them off. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, yeah, somebody walks into the emergency room, literally a knife sticking out of his eye.
Right.
But yeah, like, as you tell it too, it's like, yeah, that's a freaking metaphor about like so many parts of our life and just yanking it out. But like, I mean, you can take that in so many different directions.
Right.
But yeah, I love the way he works with big metaphors and small. As we were talking, that, you know, I totally agree with everything you were saying. And like, there's an amazing movie called Half Nelson.
With Ryan Gosling.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know if I think he might have gotten an Oscar nomination.
He did.
Yeah. It was the first movie, like, before most people had ever heard of him. In fact, that year it was like, oh, there's four nominees and then this guy you didn't ever hear of.
Right. Because it was like right around the time of The Notebook. And so knew him. Oh. I think I saw it because I had seen him in The Notebook. Oh. But if you weren't like a 16-year-old girl,
right,
you probably weren't like, oh my God, Ryan Gosling's so good.
All right. I'd never seen The Notebook. So I don't know who turned me on to it, but I think some review or something. But and he's a high school teacher in a African-American school with like, and he's a mentor with girls. Like, wait, is he the basketball coach or something? Or no?
I can't remember. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's a black school.
Yeah, but then he's like, yeah. And it opens basically, I thought it was like To Serve with Love.
Yeah.
From the 60s with Sidney Poitier. Except then it's like, oh, if like 15 minutes into the movie, then Sidney Poitier, we find he's literally in a bathroom stall, you know, getting high on crack and like passing out. And then, you know, one of the little girls who looks up to him, like, finds him. But then, yeah, it's very much what you were talking about. So then, like, it's been a while since I've seen it. But then there's a black guy who, like, I guess is a relative of hers, right? Mm-hmm. Is like, and is, a drug dealer. But isn't he, like...
I can't even remember the movie, so. Honestly.
But, I'm pretty sure he is. But, like, and, like, so they're both sort of, like, being a mentor to the girl. And
right.
They are. And the girl's like, these are the two men in her life,
right,
the two people, responsible people in her life, who are really sort of like pulling her through and mm-hmm. maybe getting her out of this. Mm-hmm. And when they meet each other, both have contempt for each other mm-hmm. and want her to stay away from him, because the drug dealer is sort of like, he's a freaking user, he's no good.
Right.
And the teacher's like, he's a drug dealer, he's no good. And they're both objectively sort of right. I'm like, okay, well,
neither of these things are great for children.
Exactly. But they're both wrong, because like, they're both making the best of a bet. And you know, and he also is a drug addict, partly because he's trying to be the white guy working in this school and doing this for these girls. But maybe it's sort of in over his head and it's like freaking killing him. And so this is his escape.
Right.
And so he's like a good guy kind of fucking up and trying to like, and that's kind of what the movie is about. It's like, well, who is the, and it's like, and it's easy to see them as like the bad guy, except like, freaking trying.
Right.
And he's like really trying to, and he's doing the right thing, and he right. is really helping her.
Right.
And, but yeah, I like those things where it's sort of like, I'd forgotten that. Like, there's a lot of this
yeah.
thing going on.
Well, and also with like Half Nelson and a lot of movies that have that narrative of like, white guy comes in to save community. It's like, there's a sense of entitlement. And also in this book, there's a sense of entitlement like that. And that's what I think I appreciated most about what Dennis Johnson did, is he really captured that sense of like, I'm going to be fine. Like, who fucking cares? I got this. I run this show. Mm-hmm. Like, this is my life, whatever, that I think comes from like a confidence mm-hmm. and that is just like, that is inherently young white men, like that they have that sense of like, the world is mine. And like, you know, I don't think that he approaches that part where he does an OD and die and the other guy does as like, I got lucky. I think he sees it as like, I did it right kind of thing. And like that entitlement, like he talks about his girlfriend who dies, Michelle. And he's like, I was the only person who could ever really love her and like who she could ever really love. And that like, there's so much of that in this book that I was like, that is so right on. That is so a 25-year-old white guy who thinks he has it all figured out. And like, you know, the book ends and he's still pretty young and, you know, probably a week later he ODs and dies, you know?
Yeah.
And like, that's shitty. But also I think those were the things that I really like could latch onto in this book, is like the characters and how vulnerable they were, even though they were presented so confident.
That's really interesting. I guess there is like and just like you can be a drifter for a while, like the car crash with hitchhiking. I'll do that for a while, then I'll go back and I'll have my career or whatever. Mm-hmm. I guess with me too, like even, I don't know if this, like even dropping out of school to join the army. I mean, my mom, by the way, cried and begged me. And was like, my dad too, but especially my mom was like, don't drop out of school.
Right.
Drop out, never go back. Right. I was like, well, I'm going to go back. I'm not done with that yet. I'm like, I'm not that guy. But I get, I bet if I were an African-American or whatever, Latino family, there probably would have been much more pressure. And it's like, less latitude, I guess, to take
right.
the risk.
Well, the implications of being a black high school dropout are totally different.
This was college, but still.
Right, or college, whatever. Yeah, but like that it's a different thing and that the opportunities are different. And like, obviously, you said last week, you know, your brother is a lawyer and your sisters are pilots. And so that there is some sense of like, it's going to be fine, you know? Yeah. So I think that that's super interesting.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. Okay. I do want to ask you... before we talked a little bit about the movie, I always ask about the title and the cover. And I know that this is a later cover. And I think you said you have an earlier edition, but, what do you think of the title Jesus's Son? I know it comes from the, what do they call that? Epigraph or something.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm terrible with this word.
Yeah, me too.
It's a lyric and it just says, it's from Lou Reed's song Heroin. And it says, when I'm rushing on my run and I feel just like Jesus's son. So that's the epigraph. What do you think of the title?
The one thing I don't like about this book. I mean, the song is, have you ever heard the song, Heroin? I mean, it was a really controversial song, even at the time. I mean, it's basically like describing the needle going, I mean, it's about the wondrous experience of heroin.
Got it.
Yeah. how wonderful it feels. But I don't know. I have a trouble even making the connection. My biggest problem, and maybe he just loved doing this, is also just sort of shooting yourself in the foot. Like every time I recommend this book, I have to tell people, you know, like basically like, it's not an evangelical book, you know, it's not like a Christian, like it's...
I had to Google it. I was like, hold on a second.
I know, right? It's like, I feel like an eye roll is like, oh, what? Like, are you trying to let... I feel like you know, a Jehovah's Witness at the door handing you a watchtower.
Right.
You know, like, or a Mormon's like, oh, I just want, can you read... I know. As soon as I'm suggesting it, and I'm thinking of like cringing is like, and now I just almost don't even. Or I mean, it's just all right. It's not about what you think. I tell people like Jesus' Son is from a Lou Reed song about heroin.
Right, you know? And then you're like, okay, I'm willing to do this. Like,
but a title that has to come with an explanation that's like, you know. So maybe he did. I mean, sort of commercially, he's written, but also just I don't know. And even like maybe I just have a resistance. I've never. Some of my friends have like tried to explain like, yeah, that's brilliant, the connection, but I don't know. It's a long way.
Yeah. So one of the things I noticed, I think, is that every story has the word Jesus in it.
Oh.
But I think it's more like people being like, oh, Jesus, da-da-da-da-da. Like, but I think I started paying attention a little bit late and I noticed it in at least like 3/4 of them. But I didn't actually go back and reread the whole book. But I feel like there is the word Jesus, though usually like as more of an expletive as opposed to religious, in each of the stories. I agree. I don't love the title. I also don't love this cover.
I hate this cover.
I think this cover looks like a Broadway play from like 2002. Like it's totally a Playbill cover.
Yeah, I know. It could be Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah.
You know, okay, so I met Catherine Sockett. Is that her name who wrote The Help?
Yeah, okay.
Our books came out almost the same time. And so we did a book festival in Nashville, like when her book was just starting to hit. It was on the bestseller list, but it wasn't a whole phenom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was still in hardback. It was just out like a month or so. And she said, so there are two book covers because the UK publisher, like most people, is a different publisher. And they had two different, very different book covers. Mm-hmm. So the UK cover, I can't remember. I guess it must be like a, you know, black maid and a white woman or something. But and she said, you know, the American cover, I don't know what the paperback is, but the original cover is like, I believe it was like, it was sort of a drawing of two birds on
on a line, clothesline or something.
Or a wire line. Electrical line. And she said like, in other words, absolutely nothing to do with the book.
Right.
And you know, she said this openly, like there were a lot of discussions like, they're really afraid of publishing this book and terrified of putting anything on the cover. So they sort of like punted and put like nothing to do with anything. That could be the cover of any random book in the world. There's nothing to do with it. And I kind of feel like that's what they did with this.
Yes.
It's just sort of like the title, his name, and some green and yellow splotches. It's we can't figure out what to put on this cover, so we're just like not putting anything.
Yeah, which is a kind of a bummer.
I know that. I mean, I get you don't want to go real literal,
right? You don't
I'm
have sure like a what, heroin needle,
yeah.
But like, I feel like there's a middle ground.
I know, or something, or be cool. Yeah. I know. It's just
whereas nothing. Your book's covers are like, poof. Like you. I remember when I saw the cover for Parkland, I text my friend who I had a book club with where we read Columbine, and I was like, have you seen this cover? Like, it's just so, I mean, between the titles and the cover, you know what you're getting. There's no like, I wonder what this Columbine is about.
Well, you know, okay, so I can, I love my publisher, HarperCollins. They're sort of wonderful. My editor was fantastic, but they were a little slow. That was the third cover.
Really? I mean,
third.
For which one? For Parkland?
For Parkland. For Columbine, that's the first one they sent to me. But the Columbine cover has won like 30 design awards, book cover awards, and then just
it's like kind of a perfect book cover.
It's I mean, I didn't have anything to do with creating it, so I'm not bragging.
Authors always say that, but it's still perfect.
Literally, it's won zillions of awards from just like overall design. It's a work of art. I freaking won the lottery.
Yeah.
But he's got a website. The guy who did it.
What's his name?
Henry Sin Yi, I believe.
Okay.
So he's got a website. He's done this with several of his covers. But he does it with Parkland, with Columbine. His process of figuring it out. And he shows you like 10 other photographs. Completely different. Like one is like the hallways of the Columbine, the lockers.
Right.
Random things that he tried. And his whole process of figuring it out, which is fascinating in itself. The whole entry is just on that book and how it went. So I recommend that too if you like the cover. But So I knew I needed to sort of like brand myself, you know, and like do something similar. I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago on my website, I created a mock-up book cover for the Gay Soldiers book. I just took the same typeface. I took a founder's picture. Actually, it's the one that we used for the salon thing. And used that photograph, doctored it, and then like made a mock-up of my Gay Soldiers First thing, which you'll find on my website, in Microsoft Paint, like a piece of shit, you know, thing, and just did a crappy mock-up. You know, I used the same font the same, or close. I couldn't find the same font, but close, and in the same place. And it looked similar. I did that like several years ago. And so what we were doing, Harper was giving me these book covers that were kind of cool, but I could tell you what they were if you want.
Sure.
But not wonderful. And I kept thinking, why aren't they just doing like the Columbine cover?
Like, don't they want to copy this? It's so good. Okay, tell me about the covers.
Okay, so the first one was, it just said, I think it said Parkland, and it had a flag upside, American flag upside down.
Okay.
And I was like,
no thanks.
Yeah, no. First of all, I think it's just like a cheesy one-note joke.
Right.
And second of all, as a former infantry, soldier, I don't want to go there. I don't think that's appropriate. And so they said, okay, they threw that away. Then they came back with one that I thought was pretty powerful, but it was just all red. They gave me a couple different colors, but I liked the red one, sort of an ochre red. And then it just had like six names from top to bottom, Columbine, Sandy Hook, Pulse,
right.
You know, names of these, and Parkland, and then Santa Fe. And and then the one Parkland was like the reverse color.
Okay.
And so they were sort of like top right. bottom across the page. The top one was Columbine, and it was cut off. So the top half of it was cut off. And Santa Fe, which happened. So they were in chronological order.
Got it.
And Santa Fe at the bottom also cut off. So I thought it told a nice story of this is mm-hmm. this ongoing thing. I thought that was very powerful. So I agreed. We went with that. I made lots of tweaks, of course. But mm-hmm. And then sort of my name was like down the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was pretty powerful and told the story, but I just kept thinking like, shouldn't we just be doing the
right.
Columbine branding? So right. So what happened, and sorry for outing the Harbor people, which seriously, they've been fantastic.
No, this is not hate. This is love.
So we have a different UK publisher. They came to us with a completely different color. Basically, this cover that
got
you're
it.
Seeing.
Okay.
But instead of the bottom where it's got this photo, there was a photo of Emma Gonzalez during her March for Life speech, sort of clutching her clutching her forward and had tears streaming down her eyes. And I'm like, okay, two responses. That cover is amazing. Mm-hmm. Blockbuster. Number two, we can't appropriate Emma's image that way. You know, especially since at that time I was writing about the fact that she was trying to literally not be the face of this
right.
movement.
Right.
And I'm like, that's not fair to her. And then there was discussion with the U.S. of like whether they could, and the U.K. people assured. Well, first of all, it was just the U.K. edition, you know. So we told them, yeah, but we don't want that, and you know, we started with like legally we probably can't. And they checked into it and said, well, we checked in with our lawyers with U.K. law. We don't have to get it right, so we can't do it.
Got it.
So my agent and I were like, okay, yeah, one of the heroes of this, like, we don't want to basically be a dick to her, and like,
right,
no.
right.
They're like, okay, we'll respect that, so we'll take it off. And so then they came back with this. So then Betsy, my agent, was like, don't you think this is way better than the American one? Mm-hmm. I was like, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, okay, I got to tell Harper. She told my editor, who's wonderful, who I think had a big part of the development process, that, you know, I think for American audiences, you know, ours is probably better. And she said, but let me talk to the publisher, Jonathan Burnham, who now runs all of HarperCollins. And he looked at it and he said, oh, my God. Yes, that's fantastic.
Mm.
Well, let's show the sales staff. And they were like, oh, my God.
I yes. love it.
And yeah, so the matter
it is
like,
a total
okay,
oh, my God cover.
I know. So I was like, okay, thank you. But then I never said to them, but I said to Betsy's like, look at my website. Like, I did that like 5 years ago.
Nobody asked me.
I know. With paint, like basically the same thing with the gay soldiers. Like, yeah, take the same idea. But then I love that they did certain things that I haven't thought about. This my favorite thing about the Parkland cover is they literally made the sky blue.
Yeah.
And with Columbine, it's a sort of this grayish.
Right.
It looks dismal and bleak because it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, you know, Parkland is like, you know, they made it literal. It's fine. I don't think anybody's like found it too literal, but like it literally feels more hopeful. It's literally a blue sky, and it's like a happier version.
It's
like the summer, a happier version of that cover. And I think that's appropriate. And I think that tells a story. I mean, looking at them side by side, it's like that's the sad, dismal of like morning and the start. And, you know, that's that's hope.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But yeah, just look at them side by side. Yeah, this is such a bleak, and even the school is. Because they, you know, it's earth tones. It's
Things
dingy, and then here, you know, you get the pop of color at the wreath, and
Oh, God, I love those books. Okay, anything else we want to say about Jesus' son? I feel like we covered it.
Maybe just one other thing to get people to read it. So,
okay.
Well, this
you made it this far. We're like an hour and a half in.
True, I hadn't even thought of that.
Well, if you're still on the fence about it.
One of my favorite, I guess I shouldn't. I'll just tell the start of the story. Like, whether I should do spoilers. Like, there's a really touching story. I think it's an emergency where the guy runs over, hits something, and he gets up. It turns out it's a bunny.
Yeah.
But they realize, it's a pregnant bunny, uh-huh. and there's all the little baby bunnies in there. And they're still alive.
Yes.
And the mom's dead. But so he takes them and he puts them in his coat to keep them warm. And I won't tell you.
No, you can spoil this. If you made it this far, they probably read it. And I'll tell them spoilers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So if you don't, and so then he does all these, you know, and then he goes on and like, yeah, he's freaking high or whatever at the time and not really thinking. And then he does all these really beautiful, magical moments, like, you know, making snow angels and snow and all.
Right.
And I, as a reader, I don't know about you, but forgot all about the bunnies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, came back to the end and then like is in the car. He's like, what happened to those bunnies? Like, oh, and then he opens it, then he remembers, he looks at his coat, like, of course he crushed them.
Right.
But I think that's also kind of a wonderful metaphor of one of the things going in here of like good people trying and doing really mostly good things and finding beauty over the world. And then like sometimes just like just totally crushing, you know, the
right. Or that just like we can all only do the best we can do. And like sometimes your best just isn't good enough. Like, and that's okay too. Life's hard.
Well, I'm really curious too. Like, what did you like the book?
I did. I liked parts of it. I liked the idea behind it. I just don't think I appreciated it as much as I would have if I was a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
if
yeah,
that
yeah.
was the thing that I was into yeah. in reading. I just really like story a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I think like for me, it just doesn't speak to my taste as much, but it's good. And like talking about the stories and stuff. And I think he's working on really big things. And what I do like about the book is knowing that it was written over 20 years ago mm-hmm. is that reading it now, I think that my understanding of the world and the where we are currently in this country and like how bleak it seems at times, that this book really speaks to that moment. Like we're talking about the opioid crisis mm-hmm. and we're talking about white privilege and we're talking about people who are disenfranchised and the health system and all these things are kind of popping up in this book. And he didn't write it with any of it, any of what we now interpret it as that's in mind.
Yeah.
And so I kind of liked that being like, wait, when was this written again? Like,
oh yeah, that's interesting.
So I did like, I appreciated the book though. I don't know that I like really enjoyed it, but it's just also like, I really like nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And so I always, fiction for me always is like, okay, I got to read this. Whereas like, if it's like a, do you know what? It turns out almost everybody reads a lot of fiction. Nobody told me that my whole life when I was doing, you know, book clubs reading Columbine. Nobody let me know.
I also, you might try the Largesse of the Sea Maiden because he just wrote that, you know, the last year or so before he died. I mean, I'll warn you, it's not as good.
Okay, well, then I probably won't read it.
Yeah, but a few things are. But it gets stronger as it goes. The last two or three in there. And also, I say not as good as like one of my favorite books of all time.
You know,
sort of like,
of course.
Like, well, Anna Karenina, like, don't read, well, War and Peace isn't as good. But yeah, but I feel like with Dennis Johnson, no one else thinks about the world the same way. By the way, you know, I'm going to throw out one other word that I can't believe I got this far without mentioning All Quiet on the Western Front.
Oh, yeah.
And really, it definitely wasn't my inspiration for the Gay Soldiers book, but it was my target, which I finally realized that was definitely what I wanted to do is like, because I wanted to be a soldier. Well, I wanted to be a lot of things, but I wanted to sort of tell a soldier story, what it's like to be a soldier. And the best story I ever read on World War or soldiering is All Quiet on the Western Front.
Hmm.
And my copy, I don't know who did it. It says on the cover, something like the greatest war story of all time, which I think anybody would say it is a claim of like, you know, anybody listed probably War and Peace, maybe the Red Badge of Courage, but, you know, it'd be one of the finalists.
Right.
And so I reread it really slowly over the course of a year and just lovingly and finally realized like, I cannot write this book. And while I was trying to work on the book proposal, like I cannot write this book while that passing over my head of, I might also get myself in trouble. You know, maybe you're 7 or 8 when I was struggling with Columbine and, my agent said, you know, I wondered if like, do you feel like this big, you know, doing a true crime book, essentially, you know, do you feel like you're in Capote's shadow and like, you're going to be compared to that? And like, you know, you want to be like, you know, in the same league as that or something. And I was like, oh, no, you totally don't get like how bad I am. I was like, no, my goal is totally to do better than that. Like, that's considered a lot of people consider the classic nonfiction book ever written. It's like, all I wanted to do was like a little better than that.
I think you did. I like your book more than it. I'm sorry. I liked it. I didn't love it.
I, thing. I like that. But it'd be sort of like making a movie. It's like, well, I just want it to be a little better than Citizen Kane. You know,
right.
Like,
right.
But that was freaking me out and freezing me. And then right. I just had to let go of that. And then I realized, oh, I'm doing the same goddamn thing with the soldiers thing. But one of the reasons that I know that, and here's what I say, is not just that I feel, but I know that that's a great book, is I think I read it in Walter Reed when I was in the hospital recovering and still was a soldier. I did a lot of – that's when I first really got into reading. I had a lot of free time on my hands.
Got it.
I was in podcast and living in Walter Reed and couldn't be a soldier anymore and sort of distraught. But I did a lot of reading, and I picked up a lot of the classics, and that was one of them. Did you ever read it?
No, I haven't though.
But yeah, I was like, wow, if this guy can capture the stuff that's just like that I'm still feeling now in America in this modern world, like he really nailed it, you know?
Yeah.
And what it's like to be. It's like, that's what I want to do. I guess that's what I try to do with all my work is capture a world. You know, and coming back to Parkland, I mean, that's why I did partway through, I suggested to Gail, my editor, I was like, what if we did a subtitle, which, by the way, I also stole from In Cold Blood. Do you know In Cold Blood has a subtitle?
I didn't know that. It's on the inside?
Yeah. And I believe the original version had it on the outside.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, now it's just on the inside. And if you look, it's something like a true account of a multiple murder. And it's like a
long like
unnecessary,
okay.
Kind of like not that artistic.
Right.
But I was like, what if we do a subtitle and just have it on the inside? Birth of a Movement, because I feel like that's what it's about, and it helped me even just to have it for a while. I just
right.
had it myself. It's like that helped me. Like, what is this? And so I wanted to like capture this moment in time
mm-hmm.
and what it was like, yeah, birthing this thing. But I guess that's what I've always tried to do with my books, and always I think want to do whatever I'm writing about is like capture a moment, capture a something, you know, a situation, mm-hmm. A whatever. But like, you know, capture it, snatch it out.
Right.
This time and place and situation reality and imbue it on the page. So when you're reading it, you feel like you are there and you've been transported and like you're living in it. And it's, you know, you're part of it.
Totally. All right. Well, we have to wrap up. We've gone really long again. Sorry, everybody. Well, we're not really sorry. We don't care. Dave Cullen, author of Parkland and Columbine, both New York Times bestselling books. Very important. Because not a lot of people can do that back to back, just saying. And two of my favorite books. And yeah, so I'm going to link to everything we talked about today in the show notes, including Dave's website and how you can get his books. And just, yeah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. This has been really wonderful. What a great way to talk, spend an afternoon talking about books and
yes,
writing.
I know. So good. So
I'm
nerdy.
So glad. And thank you. Not to, you know, to kiss a reader's ass or listeners, but well, thanks for us also for hanging on this long, especially if you're listening to the second episode. But I'm just always really glad that there are people out there, you know, who love books and the writing process and who,
yeah.
you know, care about this stuff. And yeah, that makes me happy that people out there and care. And like, I know why I do.
Yeah, me too. That's why this space exists. So yeah. Thank you for what you do. And thank you guys for listening. And we will see you in the stacks. Okay, that's going to do it for us today on The Stacks. Thank you guys for listening, and thank you to Dave Cullen again for joining us. Everything we talk about on today's episode can be found in the show notes. For more from The Stacks, make sure you're following us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, go to patreon.com/thestacks and join the fun. Thanks to Audible, listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download. So go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please, please, please rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tigirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas, and I will see you in The Stacks.